a podcast brought to you by Elevation Podcasts. Hello and welcome to Elevation Podcasts. Your host for today is myself, Lynn Hughes-Williams. And today's topic of discussion is about how the rich and famous try to silence investigative journalists from printing their stories. My first guest is Professor Chris Frost of the National Union of Journalists, and followed by my second guest, Mr. David Hughes, practicing barrister of 30 Park Place, Cardiff, and he also practices out of St. Paul's Chambers in Leeds and is very familiar with defamation cases and slaps issued against journalists. Let's welcome Professor Frost.
No problem. It's good to join you.
Where do you think the balance of freedom of expression currently lies for journalists? Has there been any changes?
There have. It's a lot better than it was, say, 20 years ago. The Defamation Act of 2013 introduced some quite important concepts that have been largely missing. Before then, we'd got a reputation in the UK as being the libel capital of the world. It's where people came to sue because the law was so much weighted in favour of a complainant that they had no problem proving their case. The 2013 Act firmed up one or two areas, and particularly the area of truth, which is now, as you know, a defence. And provided we can actually prove that largely what we've said is true, then we have a defence against defamation. And so that's improved matters quite a bit. There's still a fair way to go because defamation, even now, can be used as a threat. Because even if you can prove that what you've said is true or use one of the other defences, you actually go into court and prove that costs a lot of money. You're going to lose money. It doesn't matter even if you win in court. The courts are not going to give you all of your money back. You have to pay the lawyers. You have to pay for court time. And then, of course, there's all the anxiety and the worry of fighting a case like that, particularly as it can take several years to get through the courts. So there's still a lot of pressure coming from the Defamation Acts on journalists, and those who are wealthy and are able to employ people to do these things find it very convenient to try and pressurise journalists not to run stories by making threats.
Okay, so some positive movements, but as you say, a long way to go as yet.
A fair way to go, I'm afraid, yeah.
So what would your advice be to journalists now coming into the industry? What practical steps should they take so that they don't find themselves in this position?
Well, I don't think there's any way to avoid it. If a journalist wants to get into some really serious journalism, investigative journalism, looking at the rich and famous, the powerful, and holding them to account, then they're going to run this risk. The best way to deal with this is to try and make sure that you get a job with a large publisher who has reasonably deep pockets and can support you. But even there, things don't always work out because the rich and powerful are perfectly capable of both threatening to sue a publication or a broadcaster, but also the individual journalist. And that's quite difficult to avoid. And whilst most of the big publishers and broadcasters will support the journalists who work for them, they're not able to support them if they are sued individually as opposed to the publication or broadcaster they're working for. So there are serious risks in working in important investigative journalism. And whilst it's a very sexy area of journalism for people to get involved in, we have to be aware that it can be extremely risky these days.
So some podcasts I've been listening to, I hear that costs can even be up to as much as £2 million.
It's certainly possible. You certainly have to go into it with the idea that if you lose, it could cost that kind of money.
Yeah.
So you've really got to make sure that you've absolutely got the evidence to say that what I've written is the truth. But even then, even if you eventually win, having gone through various stages of courts, your own time, your own effort and anxiety, that the cost is still quite considerable, even if you win and the courts oblige the complainant to pay your costs.
It's quite a difficult position to find yourself in then.
It absolutely is. What some journalists do, Pippa Crera, for instance, who was badly threatened by Aaron Banks, and indeed still is, she crowdfunded quite a lot, and several other journalists have done that in the past, and it is a way of helping to raise some money to fight the case. But it's not easy, and people aren't necessarily all that keen to fund those kind of things unless you've got a really powerful and important freedom of information case to present.
Yes, yeah, if you have the public support, you know, because it's such an important issue, then yes, I suppose that is a potential, isn't it? But as you say, certainly not easy. Not easy.
No, and it's yet more work for which you're not getting paid and taking up time and frankly, something most journalists could do without, if possible.
So certainly sounds like the balance still needs to shift in favour of public interest and journalists, isn't it?
Well, that's true. And we've been very pleased and supportive of the government's moves to do that. They certainly said that more needs to be done to prevent slaps. And the consultation the government put out in the middle of last year was very positive and very welcome. But we still haven't seen what they actually intend to do yet. And it may well be that with all the changes of ministers and prime ministers and all the things that you and your listeners will be aware of, that it may well have dropped to the bottom of the agenda and it may not come back again, which would be a real shame, because it did sound at one stage as though they were fairly positive about getting this sorted out.
It's keeping the conversation going, I guess, isn't it?
It is, and the National Union of Journalists will continue to press, and there are a large number of other freedom of information organisations who are also pressing the government very hard to remain on this issue, to put it back at the top of the agenda. We have our union conference in a couple of weeks' time, and there are several motions there calling on the government to reinvigorate this campaign, to bring in legislation to protect journalists. We'll never get, I don't think, any legislation that will be perfect, because, as always, the balance between our freedom of expression, but also the rights of individuals to protect themselves, their privacy, their reputation, make for a difficult balance. And if we push too hard in one direction, then it's quite reasonable that they push back. So it's always going to be a difficult balancing act. But at the moment, it's weighted very much in favour of the rich and famous, and that needs to be levered back.
What seems to be an easy solution, or some kind of solution, would it be a matter of taking it out of the London courts, do you think? Because it seems to be quite centralised in London, doesn't it?
It's certainly centralised in London. That's because the High Court is based there, where most of the defamation cases take place.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the most obvious things is to say that only people who have a specific interest in the UK, that is, the publication has largely been in the UK, perhaps, or they're based in the UK, therefore, the UK becomes a focus point for them. Only people who can prove that should be allowed to sue in the British courts. I mean, there's a case finished just recently of a very influential and rich businessman suing Swedish journalists who published in Swedish in a Swedish magazine, the circulation of which in this country must have numbered in 5 to 10, something of that sort, because they could use our courts, the Swedish courts, simply wouldn't have allowed that case to go ahead. And we need to pick up some of those ideas and say, we can limit people in this way. Sure, if you have a reputation based here, you should be able to protect that reputation here. But if you haven't really, then go somewhere else.
Yes, that certainly makes sense, doesn't it? So do you, in your opinion, do you feel that you need the higher courts to deal with such claims? Are they that complex, or could they come to the lower courts and be?
Well, they're not necessarily that complex, but they are that rare. I mean, the number of defamation cases that are handled in the years, I mean, that they I think they went, I saw some figures and I'm not 100% certain I've got this right, but the number of cases introduced last year on defamation actually rose into several hundred, which was unusual. Normally they were around 100, 150 a year.
Okay.
And therefore to spread them about the country would lose the expertise. All the lawyers who specialise in defamation are all based in London, possibly because the courses are based in London. So I'm not sure that it would be of any particular advantage to move it outside of London, in that we would lose the expertise.
Who bears the costs, and are they indemnified by employers if they are employed, or is that discretionary?
Whereas the journalist is just paid an ordinary everyday salary and probably can't even afford to pay their own lawyer, never mind actually pay any money to repair the reputation. So normally you would sue the publication, and therefore the publication takes extreme care that anything that they publish is vetted by lawyers. And the lawyers have said, yes, you've got a pretty good case. Let's go ahead and publish that story because we could fight that in the courts.
Okay.
The point about slaps is that the people who introduce a slaps case don't care about the money. They don't particularly care about their reputation. What they want to do is stop the journalist writing anything if they can possibly help it. And therefore, they sued the journalist, even though they might be employed by a newspaper. And that limits to a certain extent publication can do. Because they are answerable to their shareholders, and their shareholders can quite rightly say, well, you didn't need to indemnify that journalist, so why are you paying the court cases? So it becomes much more difficult for the publication then to support the journalist, who is then not sort of hung out to dry, but is certainly quite often left out there to cope with a lot of really quite enormous costs that are involved in a defamation case, and carry that through without very much support from their publication. Of course, if they're a freelance, then they're in real trouble anyway.
Yeah.
And that's why there aren't that many freelancers who are doing this kind of work. It's very risky. Well, even a very low-level case of somebody who says, you need to withdraw this publication, can mean that a small publication or a journalist don't have much choice, because they don't have the resources. Even writing an apology and saying we're sorry can cost you £10,000 to £15,000.
Wow.
It's a lot of money.
From a practical point of view, if a journalist really feels strongly about a particular matter and they go in to run the risk of having a slaps issued against them, then what should they make sure they do? Should they make sure they get statements signed? What are the practicalities of really tightening up any defence that they may find themselves?
Well, certainly talking to sources, they need to ensure that that's completely covered, that they take notes, but they also take recordings, that they file their recordings correctly, that they make sure they're dated, they know who they were speaking to, that their notes are dated, and that they keep that information clear, that they get any papers that they can to assist with the case. One of the big problems, of course, is that they probably want to start to talk to whoever it is they're investigating at some point, and try to get an interview with them or put the various questions to them. The problem with that, of course, is that you then alert that person that they're being investigated. And that's when the court cases start, because they really want to not have anything published, good or bad. And it's a pretty usual practice amongst the really rich and famous to introduce a case as soon as they possibly can. Just trying to think of an example. I mean, Robert Maxwell, for instance, big publisher back in, well, about 30 years ago now, so quite a long time ago, but he was renowned that if ever you started to investigate him or you started to write something, he would threaten to sue. And so you instantly got a writ Now, a writ doesn't cost an awful lot for a person like that, £5,000 to £6,000 maybe, and then they don't have to act on the writ for anything up to a year. So doesn't necessarily mean they are actually going to sue, but it says, if you carry on, then I will sue. And apparently when he died, he fell off his boat. The Gazelle, named after his daughter, who of course is now locked up in prison herself. When he died, I think 23 cases died with him, because there were 23 outstanding writs threatening to sue various journalists. And in the end, people back off and think, well, it's not worth it. I know that he will sue. And there are other rich people who are getting that kind of reputation. So really, just good quality journalism. Make sure you're being accurate, but leave talking to the person themselves till pretty late on in the process.
Okay,
so you do have to talk to them at some point to get their response.
Investigative journalism is so important for the public. People who think that they can get away with certain actions, because they are rich and powerful, they should be held to account. And so it is important that journalists can investigate.
I mean, if we want good quality journalism, informing the public about the people who are rich and powerful, who are running our lives in various ways, then journalism is vital.
Yeah.
But of course, these people know that, and that's why they try and make sure that good journalism can't happen and they do not get exposed for some of the things that they are doing.
Yeah.
Not everybody like that, of course.
Absolutely.
He said quickly, thinking about the potential of being sued. But there are some.
Let's now welcome my second guest, Mr. David Hughes, a practicing barrister from 30 Park Place Chambers and also St. Paul's Chambers in Leeds. Thank you, David.
Thank you for asking me to speak with you about this. The problem with speaking about slaps is that slaps are in the eye of the beholder. One person's strategic lawsuit against public participation is another person's legitimate reputation management, or even one person trying to protect themselves from a public pile-on. There can be times when individuals, public figures or not, are subjected to all sorts of negative reporting in the media that is unwarranted.
Okay.
Those persons, if they're in a position to do something about that, may find themselves being described as engaging in slaps. The perspective of that will change, or is apt to change, with time. What can look like a slap today may look a lot less like a slap next year.
Okay.
So I think slaps are a problem, but if we want to try and deal with them as a problem, we need to recognise why they're a problem, and we need to be realistic in how we deal with them. Slaps are a problem because they inhibit public discourse. They can inhibit the reporting of the affairs of people or organisations that should, in the public interest, be reported. And why do they do that? Well, they do that because, primarily, I think, litigation is so expensive. And it's certainly true, defamation litigation in England and Wales is eye-wateringly expensive. It may be, and in fact I think it is, that the way to deal with that is to make it less expensive rather than doing anything else. For example, the National Union of Journalists model anti-slap law that you're aware of, I think is a recipe for lots of expensive satellite litigation, lots of expensive arguments about whether something is a slap. And the problem is someone's going to end up paying for that. So I think what we should do is go back to the first principles of what we want from our law of defamation. And when I say defamation, I'm also, a lot of what I said can all equally refer to the law of privacy. But we'll talk about defamation because it's the most convenient one.
Yes, yeah.
It seems to me that what we should want from our law of defamation is that it give good protection to journalists who write stories that are true or that are in the public interest. And it's important that we recognise that a story that's not true might still be in the public interest. And at the moment, you can make a reasonable case that our law does that, because we have defences that protect publication that's in the public interest. That publication doesn't have to be true, but it has to be done in a way that a responsible journalist would do it, which means, you know, taking steps to try and make sure it is. Being careful how you phrase something. It's one thing to report that there are grounds to investigate something. It's another to report that something is true. And we should also want that our law of defamation enable people who are the subject of publications that would cause them serious harm to be able to get redress for that.
So for the layperson, how would you describe serious harm?
Well, serious harm has a bit of the quality of a slap in that it's in the eye of the beholder. The Defamation Act defines serious harm insofar as a business trading for profit is concerned as serious financial harm. Serious harm for an individual doesn't have to be financial harm. But I'll give you one example where serious harm is obvious. And this is actually a case that predates the introduction of the serious harm case, a case called Lillian Reed. And it was about two social workers who were the subject of very, very grave allegations from Newcastle Council. And the impact on them was horrific. I mean, they had to leave their homes. They were being, you know, branded as child abusers, if I remember the case correctly. And they were able to sue. They found lawyers who were prepared to act on a conditional fee arrangement, so a no win, no fee, and they were able to sue. But they took a massive financial risk in doing so. If they had not been successful, the consequences for them would have been horrendous. So although that case is an instance of people who were able to get redress, how many people who are subject to the subject of a publication that does cause them serious harm, you know, the sort of thing that would cause their friends to distance them from themselves, cause people to think twice about employing them. How many people who are subject to that sort of publication would be willing to take the risk of bankruptcy, of losing their home, on a court case? And more importantly than that, is it reasonable that as a society we ask people to have to take that risk? And it's all very well for people to think, well, you know, if your case is fine, you win. What's the problem? Well, any lawyer who's been around the courts will tell you, we've all had the cases that we were sure we were going to win, and the witness just says something different, or the judge just sees it differently to how you do, and everyone is surprised by the outcome. So even the most surefire winner, I always advise people, has got a 20% chance of being lost. So litigation is a seriously risky business. But anyway, to go back to the point that I was suggesting, there is a forum in this jurisdiction that decides sometimes simple cases, but quite often factually and legally complex cases that can last for weeks, where it has to reach findings about complex factual situations and then apply complex law to them. And that body is called the Employment Tribunal.
Okay.
The law, for example, about discrimination isn't necessarily easy. Defamation law has a reputation for being complex, a reputation that I think is somewhat unfounded. The truth is, it's no more complex than any other area of law. If you put the effort in, you can get your head around it and understand what it's about. And what's interesting about the Employment Tribunal is that costs are not generally awarded in it. It can award costs if parties behave unreasonably, but the default position, the starting position, is that it doesn't award costs. So whether you win or lose, you pay your own costs, you don't pay the other side's costs. And there are employment tribunals across England and Wales. They're in Scotland too, but we're talking about England and Wales. And if you go to most cities, you'll find a solicitor who can handle an employment law case for you. And it's not difficult to find a barrister who can handle an employment law case for you. So if you've got an employment law dispute, if you think you've been unfairly dismissed, you don't need a lawyer to go to the tribunal, but it's probably helpful if you do have one. And if you want to get a lawyer, you'll be able to find one. And yes, you'll have to pay for that lawyer, but you won't be paying anywhere near as much as you will to take a defamation case to the High Court.
So is it that you're suggesting that defamation cases can be dealt with more locally?
Yeah, I think that there is no real reason why we couldn't have a tribunal to deal with defamation cases and private information cases, privacy cases, along the model of the Employment Tribunal, sitting in regional centres across England, sitting in places in Wales. A tribunal in which, if you succeed, you get an award of damages. The employment tribunals, for many cases, their damages are capped, are subject to a cap. For some cases, they're not. Where there wouldn't ordinarily be a costs consequence to winning or losing. In other words, if you lose, you're not paying the other side's costs as well unless you've behaved unreasonably. The starting point is you just pay your own side's costs. Now that would, I'm not saying that would be a panacea, there would still be people who would have trouble affording things, but it would be much, much more affordable. And there are, for a journalist, swings and roundabouts to that. It means that if a journalist, if a media organisation publishes something that gives good grounds for being sued, it's going to be easier for them to be sued. So the public, I mean, what we saw in the Leveson inquiry, for example, was quite a lot of people who had just not been able to access justice. It wasn't that the underlying law was problematical. It was accessing it. So if you do that, it's more accessible. But what I would say to journalists if a journalist said to me, well, we're just going to be sued more often, I'd have a number of answers for them. The first is, if you are sued, it's going to be less expensive. If you're sued unsuccessfully, it's going to be less expensive still, because you're only going to be paying your own site's costs. The legal community would respond, I think, to such a move by acquiring expertise, by developing expertise outside of those who are already doing it. That's what happens when you introduce legal changes. Lawyers respond to them because there's a demand for their services. For example, we saw the Court of Protection introduced what seems not so long ago. They're probably longer than than you and I like to think.
Yes.
And what happened was lawyers were presented with this new forum that was deciding matters, so they developed expertise in it. And that would happen with a defamation tribunal,
okay,
or a publication tribunal. Instead of going to, I mean, look, there are very good solicitors outside of London who deal with defamation work, but the defamation market is dominated by London.
And is that the reason why costs are so high? Because it is dealt with in London?
It's part of the reason. It's also, defamation cases generally have to be issued in the High Court. They can be dealt with in the County Court by agreement of the parties. I even once managed to have a defamation case not only issued in the County Court, but allocated to the Fast Track, which, for those of your listeners who don't know, is a case designed to deal with relatively small cases that can be tried in a day. Now, most disputed defamation cases would take more than a day. That particular one didn't. I had a very sensible opponent who saw the merit in the suggestion. We had a judge who asked us, well, can I even allocate a defamation case to the Fast Track? And we said, well, there's nothing that says you can't. So, and we're both saying that you should. And very sensible man, he did so. But the London centricity of the market is a problem for costs. Like I say, there are very good solicitors outside of London who do defamation work. There are some barristers outside of London who do defamation work. But if this tribunal system were tried, you would see more of those.
Okay.
And costs would come down.
Yes,
so
yeah.
Not only would there be, say, for example, you've published someone and someone wants to sue you. Not only are you not facing the prospect of paying their costs, but your own costs are going to be much, much lower because there will be market pressure. You won't think, well, why do I have to go and see these people who are charging me a fortune in London when there are X, Y, and Z firms local to me who have someone who knows what they're doing, and those people can instruct the barrister in the set of chambers in my local city and they'll know what they're doing. So you'll see a downward pressure on fees there. I realise it may be strange for a lawyer to be arguing for downward pressure on fees.
It's unusual, yes.
But there we are. And if you do that, you would have to think, for example, what you would do about injunctions. Because injunctions, there's a tendency to only want judges of a certain level to be ordering them. But that's not insurmountable. And it's a lot less hard than trying to agree on what a slap is.
Okay.
Because I suspect people's view of a slap will be, do I approve of the person who is said to be bringing the slap or not.
Is there any live conversations about changing the system right now?
There doesn't seem to be, because the conversation is dominated by London-centric voices. And if the same people are having the conversation all the time, no one's thinking outside, people aren't thinking outside the box on this. The real point, I would say to this, I mean, I've seen the NUJ's draft bill, and it does contain some interesting stuff, but it's not thinking outside the box. It's trying to define a slap, which is the moment you try and define something, lawyers are going to argue about it, and that's going to cost you money. Yeah. And as you go up through the court pyramid, it's going to cost more and more money. And until it's finally decided by the Supreme Court, if they give you a decision that's, you know, if you're lucky, they'll give you a decision that's workable and you think, right, I can now advise on this. until that happens, you've got uncertainty about advice.
Okay.
And that's problematical because that itself can inhibit publication. So my own view is that I'm not going to say that the underlying law is perfect, but I'm going to say it's much less of a problem than the cost of accessing it.
Are there any other points that you think are relevant?
I think that's the main one. Yes. I think I'm reluctant to get into a conversation about individual cases that may be slaps or not, simply because, like I've said, I think that people's view of whether they're a slap will be influenced by whether they approve or not of the person bringing the claim. I certainly know that would be the case for me. I mean,
yes.
I suppose the other thing to remember is that whether something is a slap in the public's mind is going to be an impressionistic view rather than structured decision-making that a court has to undertake.
Yes.
Undertake. Yeah. And legislation that tried to identify slaps would, I suspect, end up disappointing quite a lot of people. Why do something really hard when you can take the problem away doing something really easy?
Yeah. Very straightforward, yes. Watch this space, I guess.
I will listen to the rest of your podcast with much interest.
Thank you very much.
Not at all.
Thank you. Right. Yeah, so I don't think I can play it. Thank you to my guests today for sharing their knowledge and experience. You have been listening to Lynn Hughes-Williams, and this podcast was brought to you by Elevation Podcasts. Please hit the subscribe button below and make sure you hit the alert button to be notified of our next podcast show.